The other night, Chris Smith said something about that the older that he gets, the more meaningful some of the simplest things are and some of the simplest songs that we sing in life can be to you, the more meaningful they can be. And as we were singing the song that Brother Caleb led us in just a few minutes ago, right before we partook of the Lord's Supper, I noticed that there was a stanza, a verse, I don't know, I'm not musically inclined, whatever it is, but it was very simplistic, very short, and yet is so powerful. It said that he was born to take my death, slain to give me life. Jesus, Son of God. How much is captured in so few words? Born to take my death, slain to give me life. It's a beautiful song, and one that I hope as we sing more in the future, we'll glean much from it and be encouraged by it. In the book of Hebrews chapter 11, and beginning down in verse 32, the writer of Hebrews says, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release, so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect." As you read through this chapter in the book of Hebrews, it was written for our encouragement that we might look back to the examples that were given to us in the past, those men and women of faith who lived their lives in difficult situations and difficult circumstances, and yet because of their faith in God, they conquered all. And when I say that they conquered all, they conquered this world because of their faith in God and because of their trust and belief in God. One of those names on that list came up to me again this week, and that is the name of Gideon. Gideon is an example for us and one that we've studied many times in the past, but we're going to look at it again this morning because there's so many good things that we can learn from him. So as you go ahead and turn your Bibles back to the book of Judges, Judges chapter 6 to be specific, we need to remind ourselves of the time frame in which Gideon lived. Gideon was one of the judges of Israel. And Gideon came along after the time frame of Deborah and Barak or Barak or ever how you want to say his particular name. He came along after that, and the land there had enjoyed some time of peace because of the guidings of those judges before them. But unfortunately, the cycle that was associated with the Israelite people came up again. They would turn away from God. And when they turned away from God, they would turn to idols and they would turn to following after the people of the land rather than staying with God's law. God would oppress them, or he would allow others to oppress them because they were not following him. And then they would call out again to God, looking back to him, asking for deliverance, asking for help. And it's during this particular part of the cycle that the Israelites have now turned back again. And for 7 years now, they have been oppressed. And they've been oppressed by the people of Midian, a group of people that were kin to the Israelites, far akin as it were, because they were of descendants of Abraham through Keturah. They were people who had oppressed Israelites in the past through Moab, if you look back in the book of Numbers chapter 22. They lived on the east side of the Jordan River, primarily down around the southeastern portion of the Jordan River, down around the Dead Sea area. And these people, along with the Amalekites or Amalekites, there's about 18 different ways you can say every word in the Bible, so don't worry about that too much. And those two groups of people, and also it said the people of the east, came across, and they would come over, and they would come about the time in which the crops would be ready to be harvested, and they would just move in hordes of people. It said they looked like locusts coming in. They'd come in, and they'd bring their tents, and they'd bring all of their animals, and they'd wait, and as soon as they could gather up all the food that was there, they'd just kind of clean them out, and then they'd leave. And then they'd wait, and they'd come back and do it again. But now for 7 years this has been going on, that the Israelites would get to the point where they think that they can have their own food, and this group of people, thousands, without number it said, they would just come in and just take everything, to the point that the Israelites were having to hide from the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east. They were living in dens, they were living in caves, just trying to escape the oppression that they were receiving from them. So the Israelite people called out to God. They wanted deliverance. They wanted help. And I want you to notice that the first thing that God did here in Judges chapter 6 and in verse 7, it says, "When the people of Israel cried out to the Lord on account of the Midianites, the Lord sent a prophet to the people of Israel. And he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of slavery. And I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out from before you, and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice.'" He was reminding the people, "Do you realize that the situation that you are in is because you have not obeyed my voice?" But God is compassionate. God is loving. God knows his people. And so it says, beginning in the next verse, that God appeared to a man who was the son of Joash, the Abizarite, a man who lived in the area of Manasseh, a man who was working at the time next to the terebinth, or the oak tree, near Ophrah. And this man was working, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him. And he said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Now this man was working, this man by the name of Gideon, was working, threshing out wheat. And he wasn't threshing out wheat out in the open field as what would be common, so that they might utilize the wind to help separate the wheat and the chaff. No, he was separating, he was threshing the wheat in a wine press, so that he might hide from the Midianites. And when the angel of the Lord appears to him and says, "The Lord be with you, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." And Gideon responds, as many might expect him to, with a question about, "Why are we in this situation? Please, sir," he says, "if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian." He says, if God is with us, why are we in the situation that we are in? The angel kind of just dismisses it. Doesn't really respond to it, because the answer was obvious. The reason why they're in the situation that they're in is because you have not obeyed my voice. But the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do not I send you?" Gideon says, but please, Lord. He says, "Who am I? I'm from just this lowly tribe of Manasseh. And not only am I from a lowly tribe of Manasseh, I'm not even the most honored in my house. I'm the least of my house." Maybe, I don't know if it was by age or by size or by importance or whatever. He says, "I'm even the least of my own house." You know what he's saying? How can I do anything? How is it that I can help? But God says, "But I will be with you, and you will strike the Midianites as one man." Or you might say it like this: you'll strike the Midianites as if they were just one person, instead of this horde of people that has come. Gideon wasn't convinced yet, though. He wanted some, I don't know, convincing. He needed some confirmation. And so he says, "Will you stay here until I'm able to go in and prepare my present, my gift for you?" And the angel says, "I'll stay." So he goes in and he gets a young goat and he gets flour and he makes cakes and he makes broth and he makes the meat and he brings it back out, and the angel says, "Put it over there on the rock." And so he puts it over on the rock, and the angel takes the end of his stick that he has and he touches it, and up comes fire from the rock, and the angel is gone. Gideon realizes that he has seen the angel of the Lord. And he says, "Alas, O Lord God," down in verse 22, "for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace be to you. Do not fear. You shall not die." So Gideon built an altar there, and he called it, "The Lord is Peace." God went on to give him instruction. He said, "You need to take your father's bull and the bull that's 7 years old, and you need to go and you need to tear down the altar that is built for Baal and tear down the idol, the Asherah that is there. And then taking that, you build an altar for me and you sacrifice the bull on that altar." So that night, Gideon took 10 of his servants, 10 men. He did it at night because he was scared of his own family, scared of his own household. And he went and did exactly as God instructed him. He tore down the altar of Baal. He tore down the Asherah. And he built an altar beside it, and there he sacrificed the bull on the altar. When the men of the city got up the next morning, they went and looked, and behold, the altar that they had prepared, that they often had there for their sacrifices to Baal, had been torn down. Their idol for their Asherah, the Asherah idol, was torn down and it had been used to build an altar to offer up a sacrifice now to God. And they said, "Who did this?" Well, now, Gideon had taken 10 men with him. You get 11 men together and there ain't no secret no more, is it? It's going to be found out pretty quick. And so they find out that it's Gideon. And so they go to his father, Joash, and they say, "Bring him out before us. He needs to be held responsible for what he's done," essentially. But Joash said, "Will you do something for Baal? Is Baal not a god? Can he not take care of himself?" And so from that point forward, some people called him Jerubbaal. That is, that Baal would contend with him. But it says there that after this, that the Lord clothed Gideon. The Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Abiezerites were called out to him. Now this is happening because now all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east had crossed over the Jordan, and they had gone down into the valley, into the plains of Jezreel. And so he calls out for the people of his hometown. And then he calls out for the people of his tribe, Manasseh. And he calls out for the people of Zebulun and Asher and Naphtali. And they come out to meet him. And they're going to go up against this large army of Midian. And so again, Gideon, wanting some confirmation, wanting to have something, some affirmation behind it, he says, "God, will you show me a sign? I'm going to take this fleece, and I'm going to leave it on the ground. And in the morning when I get up, I want to have it such that the fleece is full of dew. It's wet. But all the ground around it is dry." So he goes to bed. He gets up the next morning and he looks, and behold, the ground is dry and the fleece is, we might call, sopping wet. Right? Because he's able to take it and he's able to squeeze it such that a whole bowl full of water comes out. He says, "Please permit me, Lord. Let me do this one more thing. Don't be angry with me. Let me test you this one more time. Tonight I want to set the fleece down, and in the morning I want to wake up such that the fleece is dry, but the ground all around it is wet. So he does. God is patient with Gideon, and he wakes up the next morning and the ground is wet, but the fleece is dry. So Gideon has his army now. He's had this confirmation from God that he is with him. But God says, beginning in Judges chapter 7, and in verse 2, because the army is gathered together around the spring of Herod, and the Midianites and the other people of the east are down in the valley of Jezreel, God says, the people with you, Gideon, are too many for me to give you the Midianites into your hand, because Israel will boast. He says, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. You got too many folks with you, Gideon. They'll take credit for it for themselves. So here's what you do. You take them down. And first thing you do is you say, any one of you that's scared, you go home. So Gideon appears before him. And he says, if you're scared, get out of here. Go home. 22,000 left. You might say, well, now if it's 22,000 and yet there was two men, that's, you're still in good shape. 22,000 out of 32,000. He's left with 10. God says, that's still too many. I know how these people are. That's still way too many. So I'm going to tell you what to do. And when you go down here, I'm going to tell you who to keep. And those that I tell you to keep, you keep. Those that I tell you to send home, you send them home. So Gideon does. He says, you take them down to the water. There's going to be some that kneel down to drink, and there's going to be others that lap it up like a dog. I've read this story a million times, and I have yet to figure out exactly what that means. I don't know if that means they do, and then they just lick it up, or if they, I don't know. But whatever it is, okay? It's two different ways in which they did it, okay? And out of the two different ways in which they did it, 300 did it one way, and 9,700 did it the other. Now, if it was me and you, we'd say, well, we're going to send the 300 home. But that's not what God said. God said, you send the 9,700 home, with the 300, we'll take them. So Gideon sends them home, the 9,700. And now it's him and 300 men that God has selected. And God tells him that night, he says, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. He says, you need to go against them. I have given them to you. But if you're afraid, here's what you do. You go down there and listen, and you'll hear something that'll encourage you, and then you'll be ready. Now, Gideon has already received the sign of the angel. Gideon has already received the sign of the fleece being wet. Gideon has already received the sign of the fleece being dry. And yet God understands that he's still a little apprehensive. And so he says, I'll give you one more. So he goes to his servant. And his servant's name is P-U-R-A-H. I don't think that's how you pronounce it, but that's how you spell it. And he says, we're going to go down to the camp. So they go down to the camp, and as soon as they get down to the camp, Gideon hears someone saying, telling a comrade, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread, one of the smallest breads that they had, a kind of bread that you would have of the poorest of people, a barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. A barley bread rolls into the camp and basically destroys the camp. And the comrade that was listening to him said, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. When Gideon hears this, it says that he worshiped. He realizes God is with him. And he worships God. And then he and his servant go back to the camp. And they say, "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." And so he takes his 300 men and he divides them into three groups, assuming 100 apiece. We like to divide things even. And he gives them a trumpet. And he gives them their torch or their light. And he gives them a pitcher to cover the light. And he says, "This is what you're going to do. You're going to do exactly what I do. And when I tell you to, you're going to blow the trumpets. And you're going to break the pitchers such that the torch is now exposed so that they can see it. And then you're going to shout for the Lord and for Gideon." And so he divides them up and they go around. Now this is a great horde of people. We learn later that we're more than 100,000 of the Midianites are there. And there's 300 of these guys. But he divides them up. And they go around and they're surrounding the camp. And Gideon blows his trumpet, breaks his pitcher, exposes his light. And all the rest of them do it too. And now the Midianites think they're surrounded by their enemy. So it says in verse 20, "Then the three companies blew their trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, 'A sword for the Lord and for Gideon.' Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army, and the army fled." They were so confused and so scared that they basically fought against one another. And so the Lord provided a great victory that day. Again, learning later that 120,000 men of Midian and the Amalekites and the people of the east failed. We're going to stop it there because there's a little bit more to the story, but we need to get into our applications real quick. We'll mention this part in the applications, but we're going to stop there in terms of the story. The example of Gideon, an example of faith. We'll get there. Hey, there it comes. Gideon, an example of faith. What are some things that we can learn from Gideon and his example that we can apply in our lives? Well, there's two major points here. First of all, one of the things that I learned from Gideon is that Gideon's faith grew. Gideon was called out to be an example of faith in the book of Hebrews in what we call the chapter of faith, the hall of heroes, right? And yet, he is someone that we can look at and say, his faith is one that grew over time. Do you realize that Gideon was taken from obscurity? He himself said that when God called him a man of valor and he said he needed to go out and lead his people, he says, "Who am I really?" Right? "I'm from a small tribe of Manasseh, and I'm even from a smaller household of my own, and I'm not even the greatest of my own house." And yet God said, "You are the one that I am calling out. You are the one that is supposed to lead my people." Did God not often take people from obscurity to lead his people? Think of just the first two kings of the United Kingdom of Israel. Where did they come from? The first king was Saul from the tribe of Benjamin, one of the smallest tribes. Saul even hid when they went to anoint him as king. He hid from them. David, when Samuel was told to go to the house of Jesse to anoint the next king of Israel, Jesse collected all of his sons except to his youngest, David, who was out in the fields working as a shepherd. He didn't even think it was worth sending for him because surely it'll be one of the first ones. But it wasn't, was it? It was the youngest son, the rough, ruddy-looking young fella, that God said, "You look on the appearance, but I look on the heart. This is the one that you anoint." See, God can use people who are from obscure places, obscure backgrounds. Gideon was one of those people. But see, Gideon was also apprehensive when he was called. Gideon's humility, I think, was very sincere. I don't think he was pretending. I don't think he was just trying to get out of something. I truly think he was humble, not thinking he was worthy of the call. And I think that because of his reaction later when they want him to lead the people. And he turns it away and says, no, God will be your ruler, not me. So I think he was very humble and he was very sincere in this, but because of his nervousness associated with this, he asked God to help him more than one time, giving him a sign. Four times he was given a sign. God, being patient with him, realized that his faith was not yet to the point that it needed to be and kept providing, didn't he? He kept providing. So he came from an obscure background. He was apprehensive when he was called. By the way, does that not remind you of people like Moses? Moses was a man, when he was younger, who was strong, confident. But then he was out in the Midian desert for 40 years. And then when God called him, he says, not me, right? Who am I? Not me. And he gave him all those excuses. See, I think in both cases, God was keeping preparing them that their faith needed to be relied upon in Him and not on themselves. But you see, Gideon's faith in the end, because it continued to grow, allowed him to lead the people. I want to read again for you Judges 7, verses 15 through 18. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand. And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put the trumpets into the hands of all of them in empty jars with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. Do you see a man that turned from saying, not me, you can't mean me, to someone and said to all the 300 men as they're going down to approach over 100,000 of the enemy, arise, God has given them into your hand. You think he's changed? Look at me and do what I do. You think he's changed? He is someone whose faith grew. God expects us as Christians, as his children, to grow in faith. He doesn't expect us that when we first become a child of God, to have the same kind of faith as someone as a Gideon, or to have the same faith as a Moses, or a Daniel, or a Job, or name anyone that you want to name. Not when we first become Christians. He doesn't expect us to have that depth of faith. But what he expects us to do is to grow in faith. That's why so many different passages in the New Testament talk about us growing in faith. In the same book of Hebrews, in chapter 5, verse 11, down through chapter 6 and verse 1, he talks to them there about their faith, and he said, by this time you ought to be teachers, but now you have need that we return and someone teach you again the elementary principles of the law. You have need again of someone just feeding you milk and not strong meat. He says, if you had been practicing it, if you had been studying this, if you had been growing in your faith, we'd be past this point by now. So he said, let us go on to maturity. See the point? God expects us to grow. Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 2 compares it to being a newborn child desiring milk. Babes, the spiritual milk of the word, so that we may grow thereby. In his second letter, Peter talks about the Christian graces, the characteristics that are associated with being a Christian. And he gives us these things that we add to our faith. Adding is increasing, isn't it? Add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and knowledge self-control, and self-control godliness and so forth. He says, and if all of these things are in you and are increasing, you will not be unfruitful or unproductive. He expects us to grow. In chapter 3 and verse 18, he says, but grow in the grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Grow. Paul said in Colossians chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, as he was talking about praying for those people who are in the city of Colossae, those Christians, that he prays asking that they will be filled with the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding so as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. One of the things that we can glean from Gideon is that we are to grow in faith. And that it's possible to grow in faith. The second one is that Gideon's faith was also useful. We've been teaching, Don and I have been teaching the junior high class. Right? Junior high class over here on the side. Time passes by so quick, these kids that are, you know, they were down here, now they're up here, and you forget what grades they're in. But the junior high class that's over here. We've been teaching them from the book of James. And the book of James is essentially, we've been trying to tell them, it's essentially a book of wisdom for the New Testament. It's similar in a lot of respects to the book of Proverbs in the Old Testament. It gives you a lot of good things, meaty things that we can learn how to live our lives in this day and time. And one of the things that it talks about is that our faith, in chapter 2, our faith without works is dead. You can't say that you have faith and not do anything. It's not congruent. It doesn't make sense. If you say that I have faith and yet you have no works, it's just the same thing as having a body and no spirit. It's dead. It's useless. Gideon's faith was not useless. It was useful. Our faith needs to be useful. And God uses people of faith. Well, how does he use people of faith? In what way? What kind of traits do these people have? Well, how about this? God uses people who are willing to work. I say, well, how do you get that from Gideon? You might say, well, that's a little bit of a stretch. Well, it may be a little bit, but it ain't much of a stretch. Because when did God appear to Gideon? God appeared to Gideon as he was next to the oak in Ophrah. And he was threshing out the wheat. He was working. He was busy. He was doing something. And God said, the Lord be with you, O mighty man of valor. And the God said, you're going to go down and you're going to deliver my people. And Gideon did not say, I'm too busy. Gideon did say, I don't think I'm the right guy. I'm from a real small tribe. I'm in the least of my own house. I think you got the wrong guy. But he didn't say, I'm too busy, did he? Gideon was not too busy to serve the Lord. As a matter of fact, if you look back through the Bible, and you look at these people of great faith, these men and women of great faith, look how many of them were busy in this life. You think Joseph was busy? He was a slave. Pretty confident he was busy all the time. And yet he was able to be faithful and serve. You think Daniel was busy? Yeah, I think he was busy. He was high up in the government. He had many things, many responsibilities, and yet he wasn't too busy to pray, was it? 3 times a day that we know of, for sure. He wasn't too busy to serve. Do you think Peter and Andrew and James and John were busy? Well, what were they doing when Jesus called them? It tells us over in Matthew chapter 4, verses 18 through 22, that he came out and Peter and Andrew were casting out their nets. He said, come, and I'll make you fishers of men. You know what they did? They dropped their nets and followed him. They went on down the road a piece. Not really, but you get the point. And they see James and John. What are they doing? Same thing. They're working. He says, follow me, and they follow him. Jesus didn't call men who were sitting back on the couch with their feet up and say, well, since you're not doing anything else, why don't you follow me? I got work for you to do. Jesus called men who were busy already. And yet they still worked. How many of us? And us is a word that is inclusive, meaning me too. How many of us use excuses, I'm too busy. I'm too busy to serve the Lord. I got a job. Okay. We all have jobs to do. I've got kids. Well, we all, most of us have kids. I got other responsibilities. Well, most of us have other responsibilities. We cannot be too busy to serve the Lord. God wants people and can use people who are willing to work for Him. Let me ask you a question. Those of you who work out in the secular, even if you don't, if you've worked at all, you know what I'm talking about. Do you go to work and you know who the busiest people are? And do you realize that when there's something important that needs to be done, who do they give it to? Do they give it to the people who are never busy? No. You know why? Because they don't typically get it done. If they need something done, they typically find somebody who's already busy and say, I know you got a lot to do, but this needs to be done. You know what typically happens? They get it done. If you're willing to work, you're willing to work for God, even if you're doing other stuff, you'll find time. You'll make time. God uses people of faith who are willing to work for Him. The question is, am I willing? That's the question. You know other people that He uses? God uses people willing to trust in Him. The one thing that comes to our mind about Gideon, when we study his life and his story, as we call it, is that he went and he conquered the army of the Midianites, 135,000 men using 300. It just astounds us, doesn't it? 300. How could he do that? Well, I can tell you one thing. It wasn't because they were trained in such a way that they could do it on their own. That wasn't it. It wasn't because they were so strong that each one of them was... That wasn't it. It's because they trusted in God. I want you to think about that for a minute. They gathered together, the army, to go down and to fight the Midianites, and there's over 100,000 of them, and when they first get together, there's only a little over 30,000, 32,000, right? And God says, that's too many. If you're scared, go home. Now we're down to 10,000. Okay, well, let's go over here. You drink your water. Okay, now you're the 300. I'm going to keep you. The rest of you go home. And now you're one of the 300, and you're looking around. What are you typically thinking when you say, we're going to go down and attack those guys? Well, I can tell you one thing. If you're thinking we're going to do it because I'm strong, you ain't going down there. You must have been thinking God is with us. That must have been what you were thinking. And God can use people who are willing to trust in Him. There are so many examples of this in the Bible. The one that I remember is looking back to King Asa, who was the king of Judah, who led his people out against the Ethiopians, who were over 1 million people, it said. But it was Asa's prayer that stood out. Asa cried to the Lord and said, O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord, our God, for we rely on you. And in your name we have come against this multitude. They relied on God. God can use people who will trust in Him. God uses people who will just do their job. This is a little thing that my boss and I have at work that we'll say, just tell him to do his job. Just do your job. We're not asking you to do all of this. Just do your job. That's all we're asking. Do you realize that it said in Judges chapter 7 and verse 21, every man stood in his place around the camp. They just did their job. That's all that we're asked to do. We're not expected to do everything. We're not expected to do everyone else's job. We're expected to do what we can do. And that's it. But when we do what we can do, then together we can accomplish much. You see, that's why it gives us that comparison of the church being like a body, a human body. If you're a hand, you're not the foot. If you're an eye, you're not the ear. Right? 1 Corinthians chapter 12. But when all those parts are doing what they're supposed to do, doing their job, everything works out well, doesn't it? That's why in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 15 and 16, it says, that which every joint supplies, it builds itself up in love. We can accomplish much. So God can use people who are willing to do their job, whatever that job is. God is also willing to use people who face their fears. See, later on, after God has caused the armies to flee before Gideon and his men, they cross over the Jordan River and they're running. Well, Gideon and his men are chasing. And they're chasing hard and they're exhausted and they're tired, but they keep right on chasing. And they've crossed over and they come to two cities, Succoth and Penuel. And they come to these cities and they ask the people there, their own brethren, to supply them with bread, to give them some strength so that they might continue on. And they say, no, I don't think so. You haven't caught those guys yet. You're 300 men. There was at least 15. There was about 15,000 that passed through here. No, that's okay. You're on your own. They didn't even receive encouragement from their own brethren. You know why? Because they were fearful. Courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is the willingness to face your fear and do the job anyway. So face your fears. I'm not good at this. I can't. We can do lots of things. When we rely on Him, that gets back up to the point above it, right? When we rely on Him. But then finally, God uses people who are willing to serve Him and not themselves. You see, in the end, after they had conquered them all, after the 135,000 and the princes and the kings and all of those were killed, the people of Israel come to Gideon and they say, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. You have saved us. Gideon says, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. You see, Gideon recognized that it wasn't him that had saved the people. It was God. And so God is the one that should rule over them. He wasn't searching for his own glory. He was searching and seeking to glorify God. It reminded me of when Jesus was talking to his disciples, and his disciples had a request, and they said, increase our faith. That's what we're talking about, right? Our faith. They said, increase our faith. And Jesus told them, He said, if you had faith like a grain of mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. He said, look at what your faith can accomplish. But then he goes on to warn them. He basically warns them that they need to be careful not to trust in themselves. And he says at the end of that admonition, he said, when you have done all that you're supposed to do, say that we are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty. You do it not to glorify yourself, but you do it to glorify Him. We have only done what was our duty. Gideon, an example, a man of faith. We started out by reading Hebrews chapter 11, saying that Gideon was one of the ones that the writer didn't even have time to talk about. Right? Time would fail me, he says, to talk about Gideon and all these others. But he does all of it to lead up to chapter 12 and verse 1, where he says, therefore, because of all of these people of faith, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Our faith can be encouraged by looking at the faith of other men and women in the past and say we can learn from that, we can do it too. So he says, since we have them, pick up your cross and follow him. If there's any way that we can help you this morning in making your life right with God, and becoming a child of God, or if you're a child of God and you haven't been serving the way that you should, and your faith has not been growing the way that it should, come back to him. God is patient, as he was with Gideon. God is kind, God is compassionate, but God expects us to do what we're supposed to do. So if there's any way that we can help you, we ask you to come while we stand and as we sing.